Members of the High Five, she said, bowing her head slightly. The Low Five is at your command. Please, allow us to retrieve the Dork Slayer for you while you complete your quest. I promise you, we will not fail. She raised her eyes to meet mine, and I could see the steely resolve in them. I glanced over at H, Shoto, and Artemis, and they all nodded their approval. Thank you, Lohengrin, I said. The High Five gratefully accepts your offer. I reached out and offered her my hand. Lo rose to her feet and shook it. Her companion stood up, too. Thank you for your help, I said. If you find the sword, you mean when we find the sword, she said. Forgive me, I replied. When you find the Dork Slayer, teleport to wherever I am immediately. I'll share my location with you so you can track me. Lo nodded. Then she grinned and abruptly transformed into a young James Spader. She gave me an exaggerated salute and said, Aye, aye, Captain. Then Lo snapped her fingers and teleported away, taking the other members of the Low Five with her. Wow, H said, turning to me. That chick is amazing. Yeah, Artemis said, shaking her head at me. I don't know how you do it, Z. You have a gift for making friends who are much cooler than you are. Humility, madam, I said. That's my secret. That and my clean, close shave. Artemis laughed and rolled her eyes. Then she turned to Faisal. Do you think that sword will really work? She asked him. Who knows, he replied. According to our Oasis engineers, Anorak still appears to function like any other NPC, at least as far as the system is concerned, so theoretically he should still be bound by the same rules and operating parameters they are, which means he can be killed if his avatar sustains enough physical damage. What if we can't kill him? Shoto asked. Are we just gonna give him the shards and hope that he'll keep his word? The mental image of my avatar handing the 7 shards over to Anorak actually made me feel nauseous for a few seconds. But then, it gave me an idea. I looked back down at the last page of Kira's notebook and reread the section describing how the players in her module were supposed to go about combining the 7 shards. By the time I had finished, the rough framework of a plan had formed in my head. When I shared it with the others, they seemed to think there was a chance it might work too. We spent a few more minutes working out the broad details of it with Faisal so that he could relay it to our Oasis admins and to the GSS security team gearing up to try to rescue Og. The second we'd finished, Artemis jumped to her feet and prepared to leave. Tell Miles and his team I'm logging out right now and that they better not leave without me. Yes, ma'am, Faisal replied. But we've already got 3 security teams on deck, along with 3 squads of aerial enforcer drones, so there's really no need for you to put your own life at risk, Ms. Cook. Ogden Morrow saved our lives once, she said. I'm going to do everything I can to return that favor. She turned to me. Stay in touch, she said. And good luck. She gave me another smile. Then she turned to go. As she did, it occurred to me that if the worst happened, this might be the last time I ever saw her. So I reached out to touch her avatar's shoulder, and when she felt it through her haptics, she turned back around to face me. And as always, she looked beautiful. Hey, in case something does happen, I said, I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry. For a lot of different things, but mainly, I'm sorry that I didn't listen to you. All this time, you were right, and I was wrong. She grinned and placed her right hand against my cheek. The last time she had done this, it was in the real world, during our week together at Ogg's in Oregon, exactly 1,153 days ago. It wasn't her real hand, but I could still feel it, and it still made my heart race. You never cease to amaze me, Watts, she said. There's still hope for you yet. She leaned over and kissed me on the forehead. Then she backed up several steps to ensure that we were all outside her teleportation spell's area of effect. Good luck, guys. Good luck to you too, Artie, I replied. Don't get hurt, okay? Artemis gave all of us one last nod. Then she teleported away, and her avatar vanished in a shower of glittering silver dust. Then I turned to H and Shoto. You guys ready to rock? I asked. Shoto nodded and gave me a nervous thumbs up. H cracked her knuckles. 10-4 and ready for more, she said. I checked the ONI countdown on my HUD. I now had just 2 hours and 28 minutes remaining before I hit my limit. H and Shoto each had about 10 minutes less than that. Faisal was about to hit the 2 hour mark, and we still had 3 more shards to collect. If the last 3 took as long to locate as the first 4 had, we were in trouble. "Buckle up, fellas," H said, smiling. "We're off to the afterworld. And when we get there, prepare to follow my lead, okay?" We nodded, and then all waved farewell to Faisal once again. H turned to me and Shoto and placed a hand on each of our shoulders. Then, just before she teleported all of us to the afterworld, we heard her shout, "Oh no, let's go." 0021. As my avatar rematerialized, my vision stabilized, and I found myself standing in the middle of a long concrete tunnel 50 yards in length, with a curved ceiling that formed a half circle with the concrete floor. Every inch of the ceiling and a good portion of the floor was covered in graffiti, all of it paying tribute to Prince Rogers Nelson, scrawled here by his fans over the past 3 decades. There were snippets of his song lyrics, pairs of initials inside arrow-pierced hearts, and thousands of messages of love and devotion, all directed toward the artist and his work. Phrases like, "Thank you, Prince," and "We love you, Prince," and "We miss you, Prince," were repeated over and over again in different colors and in different handwriting. I also saw several portraits of Prince painted on the tunnel walls, along with the dates of his birth and death, 6/7/1958, and 4/21/2016, and thousands upon thousands of different hand-drawn renderings of his unpronounceable symbol. I forced myself to stop looking at all of the graffiti and tried to get my bearings. Behind me, one end of the tunnel terminated in a bright half circle of blinding white light. At the opposite end, the tunnel opening was a half circle of bright green forest, just beyond a black chain link fence about 10 feet high. In an effort to avoid showing the full depth of my ignorance about Prince and his music, I pulled up his complete discography, filmography, biography, and his career timeline in different semi-transparent windows on my HUD so I could refer to them at all times. My image recognition plugin was also constantly giving me information about my surroundings, throwing it up in small windows in the air all around me, like I was inside an episode of Pop-Up Video. As I scanned Prince's discography, I noticed that he had released both an album and a movie titled Graffiti Bridge. So, in an effort to appear like I actually knew something about this place, I turned to Shoto and said, "This is the famous Graffiti Bridge that inspired the album and film of the same name." "No, it isn't, Z," H said, resting a hand on my shoulder as she corrected me. "The real Graffiti Bridge was located in another suburb of Minneapolis called Eden Prairie. It was torn down in 1991. There are plenty of replicas of the original Graffiti Bridge here, though, spread all over the planet, but this isn't one of them. This is a recreation of a tunnel down the road from Prince's home." She glanced around, smiling. "I come here every year on his birthday. This was my last departure point. It's also one of the afterworld's designated arrival locations." I was about to respond, but H was already in motion, running toward the green end of the tunnel. "Come on," she shouted back over her shoulder. "This way." Shoto and I both sprinted after her. Once we emerged from the mouth of the tunnel, I saw that it was actually a culvert running beneath a 4-lane highway bridge over a dry riverbed. The name Bull Creek Road was engraved above the tunnel entrance. We followed H as she took a sharp right onto a worn dirt path skirting the black chain link fence to our left, which appeared to run all the way around the perimeter of the forested property beyond it. The fence had a bunch of notes, purple flowers, and purple ribbons tied to it. They seemed to grow in number and density the farther along it we ran. I glanced upward, then swiveled my head all the way around to scan the entire horizon. It was hard to tell what time of day it was supposed to be. The sky was a dozen different shades of purple and was filled with luminous storm clouds that drifted rapidly across it. Eventually, the trees on the other side of the fence began to thin out, and beyond them I could see a circular white building, like an ivory tower, rising from a sprawling field of green grass.
Beyond the White Tower was a much larger building, also white, which looked like it was constructed out of cube-shaped building blocks of polished white marble. There were floodlights encircling the whole structure, bathing it in a brilliant otherworldly light. The image recognition software running on my HUD informed me that we were approaching the entrance of Paisley Park, Prince's famous home and creative compound. A moment later, we finally arrived at the property's front gates, which were wrought iron and covered in purple chrome. Without saying anything, H walked up to the gates and grabbed one of the bars with her right hand. When she did, this action triggered our first needle drop, and church-like organ music filled our ears. The song identification software running on my HUD identified it as the opening of a song called Let's Go Crazy. It seemed to emanate from somewhere high above us, as if the sky itself were one giant speaker. A second later, we heard the voice of the Purple One himself, booming down from the sky like the voice of God Almighty, as Prince recited an excerpt of the song's spoken intro. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. As soon as he said the afterworld, there was a deafening crash of thunder that shook my bones, and a second later, tines of purple lightning arced across the sky. Then, the rolling purple clouds parted for a moment, revealing a cherry-shaped moon complete with stem sitting high in the eastern sky. I turned to look in the opposite direction and realized that I could also see the sun hanging motionless just above the western horizon. I found myself wondering why the afterworld had been designed this way, just before I heard the man himself explain that it was a world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night. As the song continued to play, the gates of Paisley Park began to open before us. Once they had opened up all the way, H turned to address me. Okay, she said. Opening the gates activates all of the local quests, and since we're clanned up, they should be activated for you now, too. So let's have another look at that fourth shard. I took the fourth shard out of my inventory and held it up. Prince's love symbol was still etched onto its surface, but as we watched, seven more symbols appeared on either side of it, along with a capital letter V. At first, I thought the V was a Roman numeral for the number 5 to indicate the fifth shard, but then, because of its size and placement relative to the other 8 symbols, it occurred to me that it might also be an abbreviation for the word verses. The first 7 symbols to the left of the V looked like variations of the familiar Prince love symbol, but the 8th and final symbol was very different. I didn't recognize it at all. It looked like a number 7 placed off-center inside a circular diagram of an orbiting electron, or maybe the face of an old analog timepiece with the number 7 forming the big and little hands of a clock at around 8:35. As soon as H saw this string of strange symbols appear on the shard, her smile vanished and her eyes went wide. This isn't a quest, Z, she said, looking over at me. It's a fucking suicide mission. A split second after H dropped the F-bomb, we heard a loud buzzer sound, and then a large empty glass jar suddenly appeared floating in the air beside her with a label on it that said Spud's Swear Jar. H scowled at it, then she let out an annoyed sigh and dropped a single gold coin into the jar. When she did, it vanished. I decided not to ask. Instead, I pointed down at the row of symbols on the shard. H, I said, do you know what these symbols mean? She nodded and took a deep breath. I think they mean that to obtain the fifth shard, we have to battle the 7, H replied, pointing to the 7 love symbols on the left, by joining forces with the original 7. Shoto and I exchanged confused looks. H continued. The 7 are a team of 7 different NPC incarnations of the Purple One, each from a different stage of his career, each with godlike powers. Have you done battle with any of them before? Shoto asked, innocently enough. Of course not, H replied, clearly offended by the question. You're asking for serious trouble if you attack any incarnation of his royal badness on the afterworld. Facing down 7 at once is suicide. Would you visit Mount Olympus or go to Asgard to pick a fight with all of the gods? Only non-fan, level-grinding tourists ever even attempt to do battle with the 7, and every last one of them gets zeroed out as a reward for their insolence and hubris. Yeah, I replied, but that was probably because none of them were true Prince fans. But you are. You know everything about him and about this planet. Come on, H. I pointed down at the symbols on the shard. If we have to fight the 7, where do we find them? H hesitated before answering. Then she sighed and nodded toward the southern horizon. There's a temple out in the desert, 7 miles south of the city, she said. The Temple of 7. In the center of its courtyard is an arena, and if you set foot inside it, the 7 incarnations of Prince are summoned there from all over the afterworld to do battle with you. H took off running again through the open gates of Paisley Park, once again motioning for us to follow her. Why are we going in there? I yelled after H. I thought you said the arena was in a desert outside of town. We can't go to the arena yet, she replied. First, we gotta collect a few weapons and power-ups, like a lot of them. I'm already carrying plenty of weapons in my inventory, Shoto said. And so are you. We can loan Parzival anything he needs. H shook her head. Conventional weapons won't work against his royal badness, H said, in any of his 7 incarnations. Only locally forged, sonic, percussive, and musical weapons can affect the 7 and their familiars. All of them are armed with deadly sonic weapons, too, and some of them are powerful artifacts that can deal enough damage to kill your avatar with one attack. That's why we need to gear up before we attempt to face them, okay? And boy, do I love wasting precious seconds myself, because y'all don't trust me to know what I'm doing. We trust you, H, I replied. Lead on. She led us on to the front entrance of Paisley Park. As soon as we reached it, H opened one of the glass front doors and waved us inside. We could hear the opening of the cheerful song Paisley Park emanating from within. First, we need to go in here, she said. And by we, I mean you, Z. This is your quest to complete. But I'll walk you through it step by step, okay? Okay, I said, reluctantly peering inside. A split second later, I felt H's foot hit me squarely in the small of my avatar's back, propelling me forward, through the doorway, and into Paisley Park. The moment we reached the foyer, H began leading, prodding, and dragging me forward through the building's maze-like interior. Shoto followed close on our heels as we sprinted up and down Paisley Park's marble hallways and through its ornately carved wooden doors, many of which were marked with either a moon or a star. H led me from one padded purple velvet room to the next, occasionally stopping to tell me to touch a specific object or undergarment to gain access to a secret passage, which would lead us to yet another padded purple velvet room. By following her instructions, I was able to collect 5 hidden pieces of a love symbol-shaped power cell, which H said we needed to repair a spaceship that was parked up on the roof. Luckily, she already knew exactly where and how to obtain each of the 5 pieces. As we sprinted from the candle room, to the music room, to the boudoir, to the virtual video room, a song called Interactive played on a continuous loop in every room. H explained that this was a song Prince wrote exclusively for a Myst-like video game he released with the same title. In the game, players had to collect 5 pieces of the Prince symbol hidden throughout Paisley Park, and this was a recreation of that quest. After we collected the first 4 pieces, H led me and Shoto down another carpeted corridor into a large open room filled with museum exhibits. Dozens of Prince's outfits and instruments were on display inside glass cases. H hurried past them toward the opposite side of the room without stopping to look at anything. Shoto and I did the same, following behind her single file to ensure that we only stepped where she did. When she reached the door at the other side of the room, she threw it open. But then I saw something catch her eye. Parked off in the far corner of this room, surrounded by velvet ropes, was a purple motorcycle. I tapped an icon on my HUD to zoom in on the placard mounted on the wall behind it, which identified the bike as the 1981 Honda-matic that Prince rode in the movie Purple Rain. "Wait here," H shouted over her shoulder as she ran across the room and leaped over the velvet ropes. I thought she was going to hop on the bike and steal it, but instead she pulled a giant serrated Rambo knife out of her inventory and slashed the motorcycle's tires, then stabbed a large hole in the side of its gas tank. When she rejoined us at the exit, I saw tears glinting in her eyes just before she wiped them away with her hand. I had to immobilize the Honda-matic now so that later on, when we face Purple Rain Prince in the arena, he won't be riding it. And that might save our ass because he won't be able to use it to run down Morris. That bike is his Achilles heel. "Morris who?" Shoto and I asked as we chased after her. H blurted out a reply, but she was too far away and moving too fast for us to make out any of it. She led us out of the museum and down another series of corridors to another door. When she opened it, there was a spiral staircase on the other side, suspended in an endless starry void. It corkscrewed downward through a field of stars, galaxies, and nebulae. We followed H up this long spiral staircase until we arrived at a door labeled Studio. Inside, we passed through a large wood-paneled control room filled with giant mixing boards and recording equipment, and then on into the main recording studio. H sidestepped the piano, then hustled over to a red painting of two women hanging on the wall, which she slid aside to reveal a safe hidden behind it. She entered the combination from memory and opened it. The fifth and final piece of the love symbol power cell was inside. Once all five pieces were reassembled, the power cell began to glow. H led us back up the surreal spiral staircase all the way to the top into a large domed room. Just as she had promised, a large purple spaceship sat parked in the center of it. It resembled a giant thimble with half a dozen capsule-shaped tanks bolted to the outside. H pressed a button on its exterior and a hatch opened in its perfectly smooth hull. The three of us crammed into the ship's tiny purple velvet-lined cockpit, and H pointed out a love symbol-shaped indentation in the control panel in front of us. I placed the love symbol power cell inside it. The control panel lit up, and we could hear its engine powering on directly beneath our feet. At the same moment, the domed ceiling above us split apart like the segments of an orange and retracted to reveal a starry night sky filled with billowing purple clouds. H gave me a thumbs up. Then she took the ship's crushed velvet-covered steering yoke in her hands and launched us into the sky. She circled over Paisley Park a few times, then turned the ship east toward the distant Minneapolis skyline on the horizon. H pulled up a map of the afterworld on the ship's navigation display. The planet wasn't a globe, but it still rotated like one, spinning like a love symbol pendant suspended from an invisible chain in virtual space. Most of the surface was covered by a surreal, shrunken-down version of mid-80s Minneapolis, Minnesota, but it had streets and locations from L.A., Paris, and several other locations scattered throughout. The map divided the city into different neighborhoods like Big City, Erotic City, Crystal City, Beat Town, and Uptown. H flew us directly into the heart of downtown and set the ship down in the middle of a busy intersection, directly in front of a place called the Huntington Hotel. H opened the ship's outer hatch, but before we exited, she removed the love symbol power cell from its cradle and stashed it in her inventory, causing the whole ship to go dark and power down. The street outside was crowded with NPC pedestrians and motorists, many of them cursing and honking at us for abandoning our purple UFO in the middle of a busy intersection. H ignored them and headed for a large fortress-like black building on the opposite corner of the street. A curved sign over its front entrance read, "First Avenue," in large capital letters. H pointed further down the street, at a side entrance that led into the same building. It had a small awning over the door, with 7th Street Entry printed on it. She told us to wait for her there, then she sprinted straight toward the club's front entrance, like Lancelot storming a castle single-handed. As she went inside, I pulled up her POV video feed on my HUD, giving me a glimpse of the interior. H was pushing her way through a dance floor that was packed with hundreds of NPCs of every race, creed, and social class. Teenagers and adults packed in shoulder to shoulder, all getting their groove on. Then there was a flurry of movement, during which I couldn't see much of anything. I heard what sounded like several rapid blasts from a plasma rifle. A few seconds later, H emerged carrying an all-white guitar with gold knobs and tuning keys and a gold love symbol painted on its body, just above the gold pickups. It was one of the most beautiful musical instruments I had ever seen. "Ka-ching!" H said, holding it triumphantly over her head for a moment before she added it to her avatar's inventory. "It shoots sonic blasts that are almost as powerful as the Purple Special. Now we just need a few more things and we'll be ready to head to the arena." She took off running again, motioning for us to follow. "Come on, we've got an audition." H led us down the brightly lit tunnel of neon that was 7th Street. After several blocks, she made a left onto Hennepin Avenue. We followed that for a few blocks, then she continued to zigzag her way east, leading us down a labyrinth of numbered streets and dark alleyways filled with broken bottles, busted fire escapes, and enough randomly generated burning barrels to make Donkey Kong envious. H was very specific about each turn she took, like she was entering the combination to a safe. She led us right onto South 5th Street. Left onto 2nd Avenue South, right onto South 4th Street, left onto 3rd Avenue South, and then right onto South 3rd Street. As we weaved through this maze, I glanced down a side street and finally spotted something I recognized, probably because it wasn't directly related to Prince. Hanging out in an alley were characters and settings from Break Street and Ghetto Blaster, two very old-school hip-hop video games I'd played as a kid using the Commodore 64 emulator on my old laptop. Someone had converted them into photorealistic mini-quests and then anchored them here in the back alleys of the afterworld. When I asked H what they were doing here, she smiled and shrugged. "Nobody knows," she said. "They're a weird little Easter egg left by one of this planet's original designers." "Do you think Kira could have been the one responsible?" I asked. She shrugged. "Who knows?" H made a sharp right, leading us down another alley. But this particular alley seemed slightly darker and more ominous than the others. And H must have thought so too, because I saw her take out a thermal detonator and arm it. H held up her hand to bring us to a halt. Then she pointed out a pack of feral NPC gangbangers who were stepping out of the shadows up ahead of us. They were all wearing large gold crucifixes around their necks. The NPC name tags hovering above their heads on my HUD informed me that there were 10 of them and that their gang was known as the Disciples. Each one was toting a machine gun, and without saying a word, they opened fire on us. Shoto and I took cover behind burning barrels, but H remained out in the open, letting their bullets ricochet off her shield. Then she casually tossed her thermal detonator into their midst. There was a brilliant flash of light, and all 10 of the Disciples were incinerated in a single blast. Then H kept right on walking, fanning her hands in front of her face to clear the Disciple dust that now filled the air. When we emerged from the other end of the alley, H quickened her pace and Shoto and I did the same to keep up with her as she continued to bob, sidestep, and weave through the crowd and the surreal landscape around us, which appeared to be a living mashup of all of Prince's different album covers and music videos. The streets were lined with music venues of all types and sizes. Like an overly knowledgeable tour guide, H explained how each of the venues we saw here on the afterworld was a replica of a real club or concert hall or stadium where Prince had once performed, and that you could walk into any one of them, sit down in an audience of period-appropriate NPCs, and watch a recreation of the gig or gigs that Prince had once performed there. Detailed, immersive simulations, extrapolated from old photographs and archived video and audio recordings. According to H, the best ones to check out were Prince playing in the middle of a rainstorm in Miami at Super Bowl 41 and his midnight show on New Year's Eve in 1998, when everyone finally got to party like it was 1999. We also passed a replica of Mann's Chinese Theater, where, H explained, the Purple Rain movie premiere on July 24, 1984, was always happening, over and over, on a continuous loop. We saw Pee-wee Herman pull up in a miniature hot rod just a few cars ahead of Purple Rain Prince himself, arriving in a purple limo, dressed in a glittering purple tuxedo, solemnly holding a single purple rose with both hands as his bodyguard, a giant gray-bearded gentleman in a bleach blonde mullet and a striped zebra vest, cleared the Great One's path onto the red carpet. Just a few doors down from Mann's, we passed a replica of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, where H told us it was always March 25th, 1985, and the 57th Academy Awards were always being held, just in case any visitors wanted to watch Prince walk up on stage, with Wendy on one arm and Lisa on the other, to receive his Oscar statuette from Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner. Farther down the street, we passed a nightclub with a neon sign that said Sugar Walls. An NPC of Sheena Easton was strutting up and down the street out front, and when we spotted her, it triggered another needle drop, this time for the Prince song, You Got the Look. H and I both paused to stare at her as she swaggered by, grooving and lip-syncing to her 1987 hit single. You know, Shoto said, it's pretty obvious that Prince was plagiarizing those old Jordache jeans commercials when he wrote this song. He laughed and began to mix up the song and the jeans jingle using a set of holographic turntables that he produced from his inventory. You've got the look, he sang. You've got the look, the Jordache look. H didn't respond. She just quietly backed away from him several steps, pulling me with her. A split second later, a big, fat, purple bolt of electricity descended from the sky and struck Shoto directly on the top of his head, knocking him flat on the pavement. The bolt also apparently caused enough hit points of damage to nearly kill his avatar. I saw his health bar indicator start flashing red for a few seconds until he could cast a few healing spells on himself. H walked over and helped him up off the ground. I warned you, didn't I? She said. I told you not to blaspheme against the purple one here. But did you listen to me? Shoto shook his head, but didn't say anything. A few seconds later, I realized that he couldn't speak. The gods of the afterworld had apparently muted his avatar as punishment for his blasphemy, in addition to the lightning bolt. I felt bad for him. When you were wearing an ONI headset, getting hit by lightning was no joke. It was almost as bad as getting tasered. Remember how much grief you gave me when you found out I don't like watching scary movies? H said, pointing an accusing finger at us. Well, guess what? Now the shoe is on the other foot. So listen up, assheads, and listen good. Do not crack jokes at the artist's expense. In fact, just stop speaking altogether and don't do anything I don't tell you to do. Just keep your trap shut and stick to my heels. Got it, Larry? She glared at Shoto until he nodded. Then she turned to me. What about you, Curly? Yes, Mo, I said, stepping out of her way. We heard you. Lead on, O wise one. H gave me an impolite shove, then she turned and led on. We rounded another corner onto Hennepin Avenue and immediately passed a small one-room schoolhouse. It caught my eye because it looked incredibly out of place in the middle of a crowded downtown Minneapolis street. Through one of the schoolhouse's open windows, I could see and hear Prince dancing with a whole classroom full of Muppets while singing about having starfish and coffee for breakfast. One of the kid Muppets singing along with Prince bore a distinct resemblance to him. I considered asking H if one of the seven princes we would have to face was Muppet Prince, but then I thought better of it. She still didn't appear to be in the mood for jokes. Her face was stoic with concentration as she led us through the afterworld's surreal urban landscape, and her eyes were constantly scanning the area around us, looking for anything that would slow us down. We passed the Gotham Art Museum, which I recognized as a set from Tim Burton's Batman film from 1990, a movie for which Prince wrote the soundtrack, another of the few meager pieces of Prince-related knowledge I didn't need to get from my HUD. We rounded a corner onto Washington Avenue, which took us along the border of downtown and Erotic City. Just across it, glittering like the Golden Gate, there was a nightclub with a vulva-shaped entrance. The pulsing pink neon sign above it read, "A Love Bazaar." Shoto took a few steps forward as if hypnotized, but H pulled him back, shaking her head. "You're a married man, Shoto," H said, "and we definitely don't have time to go in there right now." "I didn't want to anyway," Shoto replied, revealing that he was no longer muted. H swiveled her head 180 degrees to ogle an NPC of Sheila E. in a tight blue dress that had just emerged from the club. She sauntered right up to the erotic city border and beckoned us to cross it and join her on the other side. H looked tempted for a second. Then she shook it off and continued running. We followed her down the street, weaving our way through the oncoming crowd of NPCs in colorful costumes. One of them caused me to do a double take, a young black woman who bore an uncanny resemblance to H when I'd first met her. When I pointed H's NPC doppelganger out to her, she smiled and nodded. "That's Bonnie Boyer," she said. "She played keyboards for both Prince and Sheila E., and she was a total badass. She gave me hope. If a girl who looked like her could wind up performing with Prince, I figured there might still be a chance for me." "And look at you now," I said. "Running for my life inside a computer simulation that I willingly plugged my brain into," she said. "No, fool," I said. "I meant that now you've become an inspiration too." She grinned her giant grin at me. "I know what you meant, Z," she said. "Thanks." She was silent for a moment. Then she stopped walking and turned to face me. "What you were going through on Halcedonia?" "I get it now," she said. She motioned at our surroundings. "The Prince records and videotapes I inherited from my dad when he moved out, they were the only things he left behind. Well, besides me, I guess." She shrugged. "Growing up knowing he'd been such a huge Prince fan always made me wish he'd stuck around. I figured he probably would have been okay with my sexuality, or at least more accepting of it than my mother." I nodded, but didn't say anything. Neither did Shoto. About a year after we won Halliday's contest, I'd asked H if she ever thought about trying to get back in touch with her mother. H told me her mother Marie had already come looking for her as soon as she learned that her estranged lesbian daughter had become one of the world's wealthiest and most famous people. Apparently, that prompted Marie to abruptly change her homophobic tune, and before long, she showed up on H's doorstep. H didn't let her mother come inside. Instead, she reached out and pressed her thumb to Marie's phone and transferred her $1 million. Then, before Marie even had a chance to thank her, H threw her mother's own words back at her. "Your choices have made me ashamed of you," H told her. "Now, leave me be. I never want to see you again." Then she slammed the door in her mother's face and told her security guards never to let her on the property again. "You know what really sucks, Z?" H asked me as we continued to walk down Washington Avenue. "No, H," I replied. "What really sucks?" "Later in life, after he became a Jehovah's Witness, Prince came out as anti-gay," she said. "He believed that God didn't approve of homosexuality, so he couldn't either." "Can you believe that, Z?" She shook her head. "For decades, he was an icon and a role model to generations of sexually confused kids and adults. He spoke for us through his lyrics. 'I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I'm something that you'll never understand.'" She started to get choked up and had to pause for a few seconds to collect herself. "Then, one day," she went on, "Prince suddenly changes his mind and says, 'No, I was wrong all along. You really should hate yourself for being gay, because God says it's a sin for you to be the person he made you to be.'" She shook her head. "It's stupid. Why should I care if some old rock star gets religion?" "It makes total sense, H," I said after a moment. "First your mom rejects you. And then Prince, who was like a surrogate for your dad, he rejected you too." She nodded. Then she smiled. "Yeah. But you didn't reject me, even though I was catfishing you for all those years." I smiled back at her. "Of course not," I replied. "I fucking love you. You're my best friend. You're part of my chosen family, which is the only kind that matters, right?" She smiled and nodded again, and she was about to respond when she suddenly came to a halt on the sidewalk.
Quick, she said, pointing us toward some sort of clothing thrift store on the street corner directly in front of us. We need to stop in there. Hurry. The sign above the entrance said Mr. McGee's Five and Dime. I ran over and tried to open the front door, but it wouldn't budge. No, not that way, H shouted. Around back. Shoto and I followed her around back, and this triggered another needle drop, Raspberry Beret. When we got to the rear of the store, H was holding open a back door with a sign on the inside that said out. You can only get in through the outdoor, she explained, waving us inside. I let out a weary sigh. Then I checked my ONI usage countdown. I now had just 1 hour and 44 minutes remaining. Is all of this absolutely necessary, H? I asked. Yes, H replied, pushing me through the door. Now, keep moving. 0022. H finished walking me through the elaborate process of purchasing the Raspberry Beret. First, I had to ask the owner, Mr. McGee, for a job. Then, H instructed me to stand behind the counter and do something close to nothing, until Mr. McGee told me several times that he didn't like my kind because I was a bit too leisurely. It felt like it took forever. Once we had left the store, H forced me to put the Raspberry Beret on my avatar's head. Dude, if I find out that you're messing with me right now, there will be hell to pay, I said. This is valuable, hard-won knowledge that I've been sharing with your ungrateful ass, she replied, tilting my beret at a rakish slant and then nodding with satisfaction. A few blocks down Washington Avenue, we spotted a beautiful 1958 Chevrolet Corvette up ahead of us, gleaming beneath the bright streetlights. For some reason, the car was parked sideways, with its front end jutting out into traffic and its rear wheels backed up against the curb, instead of parallel to it like every other car on the street. It was a red and white convertible. The top was down, and a set of keys was hanging from the ignition. You drive, Z, H said. The little red Corvette won't start for you unless you're wearing the Raspberry Beret. I jumped behind the wheel. H took shotgun, forcing Shoto to hop into the back. The Corvette's engine roared to life and I pulled away from the curb and out into traffic. Nearly all of the other vehicles on the road were either a sports car or a limousine. Take that freeway on-ramp, H said, pointing up ahead, onto I-394 West. Follow it all the way out of town. Drive as fast as you can. I did as she instructed and took the on-ramp. Then I put the hammer down, pushing the engine up over 100 miles an hour. As we rocketed west, H switched on the car's radio and it began to play Little Red Corvette. When the song ended, it started over again. Apparently, it was the only song the radio would pick up. After a few repetitions, we all started singing along with the chorus, until H suddenly snapped off the radio in disgust. Hold up a second, she said, turning around in her seat to address Shoto. Did my ears just deceive me, or were you just singing Living Correct? Shoto nodded. Yeah, so, he said, those are the lyrics, aren't they? No, she replied. No, those are not the lyrics, Shoto. The title of the song is Little Red Corvette. It always has been. Shoto furrowed his brow. Seriously? He said. Then he shrugged. Wow, that really changes the whole meaning of the song for me. Shoto? H asked. Buddy? Did you happen to notice that we are sitting in a Little Red Corvette right now and that no other song will play on its radio? Listen to it again, Shoto said. Living Correct works too, I'm telling you. H looked up at the sky expectantly. I can't believe that shit didn't warrant a lightning bolt, but okay, she muttered. H continued to give me driving directions until we reached the Seven Corners area, located near the neon-lit intersection of three streets, Washington, Cedar, and 19th Avenues, all of which were paved with red bricks instead of asphalt. Despite the name, I only counted four corners. There was a different music club located on each one, each with its own giant stylized neon sign bearing the venue's name. On one corner was a club called Clinton's House. Directly across the street was a venue with an ice blue neon sign that said Melody Cool, located in a gray stone building with stained glass windows that made it look more like a church than a dance club. Across the street from it, on yet another corner, was a club called Glam Slam,
which had a giant neon Mars symbol encircling its front entrance. When we reached another little club with a big neon sign, this one called the Baby Doe Bar, H told me to pull over. I parked the car, and we all jumped out. "Okay, here's the deal," H said. "Avatars can come down here and audition for any of the local bands playing in one of these clubs. If we pass and they let us join their band, they'll fight beside us later on when we have to enter the arena. Got it?" Shoto pointed to a flyer stapled to a nearby utility pole announcing open auditions for a band called Des Dickerson and the Modern Airs. The picture on the flyer featured the band's lead singer, Des, I presumed, wearing a Japanese flag bandana. "How about these guys?" Shoto asked. "They look totally wicked." H rolled her eyes. "Oh, that's a fantastic idea, Shoto," she replied. "Who better equipped to do sonic battle against the greatest musician in history than Des Dickerson and the Modern Airs? That would really have Prince quaking in his 6-inch heels." H pointed down the street. "Better yet, why don't we just stroll down that way a few blocks and audition for Apollonia 6? "Okay," Shoto replied cheerfully. "If they have 6 members and the 3 of us join forces with them, there will be 9 of us total. We'll have the 7 princes outnumbered." I pulled up an Apollonia 6 album cover in a browser window and turned it toward Shoto. It showed 3 young women in lingerie, surrounded by mist, posing in front of a bunch of obelisks. One of them had a large teddy bear wrapped around her fishnet stocking-covered leg. "I think Apollonia 6 only has 3 members," I said, "unless you count the teddy bear." We both turned to H for confirmation, but she was already walking away from us, shaking her head at our ignorance. Shoto and I ran after her, then we ran into her. H had come to a sudden halt just ahead of us, after only taking a few steps. And once we recovered from our collision with her, we saw why. Nolan Sorrento's black armored avatar was standing directly in front of us, blocking our path. The guy who murdered my aunt and a bunch of my neighbors in an attempt to kill me. Back on the street, free as a bird. "Boo!" he shouted, making all 3 of us flinch. This, in turn, made him cackle with delight. He looked extremely happy to see us, and I found that extremely unsettling. "Wow," Sorrento said once he regained his composure. "Look at you guys. The A-team is back in action, just like old times." He took a menacing step toward us, but we all held our ground. "Don't you kids ever get tired of picking through the wreckage of a past generation's nostalgia?" He reached his arms out wide. "I mean, look around. The entire oasis is like one giant graveyard haunted by the undead pop culture icons of a bygone era. A crazy old man shrine to a bunch of pointless crap." "Why are you here, Sorrento?" I asked. "We're kind of busy at the moment." "Anorak sent me to check in on you," he replied. "You're burning an awful lot of time on this planet, and your friend Artemis appears to have abandoned you." He smiled. "I suspected that might happen. After all, if the 3 of you fail, you die, and that would leave her in control of your company." I did my best to act as though he'd really gotten under my skin. If he and Anorak believed that Samantha had bailed on us, they wouldn't be concerned with what she was really up to. "Anyway," Sorrento said, "Anorak is preoccupied at the moment, so he sent me to remind you that every move you make is being watched. Time is running out, and your deadline is non-negotiable." He smiled and then added, "So, keep your eyes on the prize, or meet your demise." And with that, Sorrento teleported away, and his avatar vanished. We all stared at the spot where he'd just been for a moment. Then, without a word, we kept on moving. As H led us toward the next intersection, we passed a copy of the Moulin Rouge, which was right next to a place called Ambulance Bar. Up ahead of us, mixed in with all of the music venues, I also spotted a video arcade called the Coin Castle. From what little I could see through its front windows, it was packed with nothing but purple pinball machines and video game cabinets. I was hoping H was headed for it, but she ran right past the Coin Castle's front entrance and continued running until we reached a large nightclub located on the next corner. It had a neon sign over its entrance that spelled out the word Pandemonium in fiery orange letters. There was a large clock mounted up above, with the time printed directly above it in all capital letters. This struck me as odd, like printing the date above a calendar. H led us up to the club's front entrance. It was guarded by the same bearded, 6-foot-tall, bleach-blonde, muscle-bound, zebra-vested gentleman we'd seen earlier guarding purple rain prints at Man's Chinese Theater. He stepped in front of the door to block our way, then folded his giant arms across his tree trunk of a chest. "What's up, big chick?" H asked, addressing the NPC like an old friend. Big Chick slid his sunglasses down the length of his nose and gave H the evil eye. "What's the password?" he asked in a surprisingly kind voice. H cupped her right ear, turned it toward him and said, "What?" Big Chick nodded, gave us all a friendly grin, and then stepped out of our way. Shoto and I exchanged a perplexed glance and followed H inside. I felt like we were walking into the hippest night spot on the 9th level of Dante's Inferno. All the lighting was reddish in hue, and there were flames everywhere you looked. Lit candles on every table, torches mounted on the walls and balcony railings, and dozens of burning fireplaces upstairs and down. But the club didn't even feel warm. And it was filled with happy chattering NPCs, beautiful people in colorful attire who were all busy drinking, smoking, dancing, and trying to seduce one another. "Gentlemen, please remember you can't stop the revolution if you don't have the time," H said, pointing across the club toward the empty stage, which was located inside a ring of fire, and said, "Dogs travel in packs of 7. The stage was currently empty except for a large drum kit. The bass drum had a familiar symbol on it, a large number 7, positioned off-center inside a large circle, with a much smaller circle set into its orbit like an electron diagram. I took out the 4th shard and had another look at it. The symbol on the bass drum matched the 8th and final symbol etched into its surface, the one that came after the V. "H," I said, "the symbols match." She nodded. "It's the logo of a band called the Original 7," she told me. "But they changed their name to that later in their career for the same reason Prince changed his, contract bullshit. They're still much better known by their original name." The crowd around us suddenly erupted into applause, drowning out her voice. We looked over and saw 7 men running up onto the stage single file. All 7 of them were dressed in stylish suits. 4 of them were carrying instruments. 1 of them was carrying a large mirror. They seemed familiar to me, but I couldn't place them right away. Then the club DJ, who also looked very familiar, jumped on the PA to introduce them. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "please welcome the Original 7 members of the greatest band in the world, Morris Day and the Time." That was when I realized how I knew them, from their cameo at the end of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and the DJ, who had just introduced them, was an NPC of Jason Mewes, probably cut and pasted here from a Skewniverse in Sector 16. The lead singer, Morris Day, waited a moment for the crowd to quiet down. Then he grabbed the microphone. "Welcome to Pandemonium, y'all," he said. "Tonight's the night. We're holding auditions, people, to fill out our roster with some new dancers for an upcoming tour. So, anyone out there who thinks they got what it takes, this is your one and only chance to dance." "All right," H said. "Get ready and try not to blow this, okay?" "Try not to blow what?" I asked. "Are you gonna tell us what we need to do?" "H?" H shook her head and began dancing backward away from me. Then, a huge grin spread across her face as the time launched into "The Bird," their hit dance single from 1984. "Y'all ready?" Morris asked from the stage. "Okay, anyone who wants to audition, I'm counting off 10 seconds to get to the dance floor. 10, 9, 8, 7. H continued to dance backward out onto the dance floor, motioning for us to follow her. A second later, Morris Day let out an ear-splitting "walk," and the song kicked into high gear. That was when I began to see falling directional arrows on my HUD that matched the arrows lighting up on the dance floor directly beneath my feet, like a giant game of Dance Dance Revolution. Shoto saw them too, and we both let out a jubilant roar. DDR! We shouted as we both began to dance in sync to the arrows. H joined us, and the three of us danced side by side, hitting our marks on the floor in perfect sync. We managed to keep it up until the very end of the song. When it was over, Morris called us up on stage and announced that we had passed the audition with flying colors. "Say, I pledge allegiance to the time," Morris shouted. "Can y'all say that?" We each raised our right hand and pledged allegiance. Then H leaned over and whispered something in Morris's ear. It sounded like the kid. Whatever it was, his expression changed and he stormed off stage, motioning for the rest of the band to follow him, including the three of us. "It worked," H said. "They've agreed to come battle with us. Let's go." We got back in the little red Corvette and sped south on Alphabet Street. Morris Day and the Time followed behind us in their tour bus, which had their logo for the original Seven painted across the side. Once we were a few miles outside the city limits, the landscape around us abruptly changed, and the road led us into a desert that appeared to stretch to the horizon in all directions. Every 7 seconds, long tines of purple lightning descended from the sky to strike the desert sand, burning and melting it into strange pillared formations of purple fulgurite that dotted the barren landscape like sentinels. Eventually, a small, lone pyramid emerged in the distance ahead of us, just off the highway, like some sort of strange roadside attraction. When we reached it, H told me to pull over and motion for the tour bus behind us to do the same thing. She told us all to wait while she ran inside to get something, and I watched from inside the Corvette as she ran across the barren sand over to one corner of the pyramid, which appeared to have no entrance. I used my HUD to zoom in with maximum magnification and saw that she was running her fingertips across the surface of one of the large stones that made up the pyramid's base. Then she leaned forward and blew a layer of sand and dust away from one tiny section of it, revealing several rows of hieroglyphs. She began to press them in a specific sequence, like buttons. I heard a loud grinding sound as a massive stone at the base of the pyramid slid aside, revealing a secret entrance. H ran through it. A minute later, she emerged again, now wearing a huge smile on her face. As she jumped back in the car beside me, I saw that she was clutching three gold chains, each with a gold pendant shaped like a different element of the love symbol. The first pendant was a golden circle, which H gave to me. The second was a golden horn, which she gave to Shoto. The last was a golden androgyne symbol, which H placed around her own neck. "All right," she said, letting out a heavy sigh. "Now we've got the three chains of gold, too. I think we're as ready as we're ever going to be." She pointed to the road ahead. "Let's go face the music, fellas." I pulled the Corvette back out onto the road, the tour bus behind me, and gunned the engine again, hurtling us forward toward the dark, luminous, purple horizon ahead. A moment later, the desert was behind us, and we were in a strange, otherworldly purple landscape with purple mountain ranges in the distance and a dark purple sky over our heads that was filled with dark purple thunderstorm clouds, with bright purple tines of lightning crackling across between them. We put the top up on our little red Corvette convertible just in time, right before big fat droplets of purple rain began to fall, creating a strange syncopated rhythm as they drummed against the car's roof and hood and on the asphalt road ahead as we continued to speed down it. A glittering at the end of the road caught my eye, and as we got closer, I could just make out that it was a structure of some sort, looming like a grand fortress or temple. As we drew near, I saw that it had seven spires vaulting toward the purple sky, each topped with a dome shaped like a Hershey's Kiss. Six of the spires were wrapped in bands of blue neon, while the much larger seventh spire in the center was topped with a golden chatri. At its perimeter, our road dead-ended in a love symbol-shaped parking lot with a mirrored surface of volcanic black glass. As we gazed up in wonder at the giant structure, the tour bus pulled up and parked behind us, and Morris Day and the rest of the original seven emerged. None of them spoke. They all just stood there waiting and looking extremely cool. Jerome walked over to Morris and pretended to dust off each of his shoulders. The other members of the time all wore grim expressions. They looked ready for a war. H led us over to the temple's jewel-encrusted gates, which appeared to be made of gold. They were standing wide open, daring us to enter. Beyond the gates, there was a large open courtyard that stretched all the way to the base of the temple steps. Surrounding both the courtyard and the adjacent temple was a seemingly endless field of purple flowers that stretched to the horizon behind them. Peering through the open gates, I caught a glimpse of several dark cat-like shapes slinking around the courtyard's perimeter. Lions or panthers, maybe. Whatever they were, they all suddenly halted in mid-stride and turned to stare at us with their glowing purple eyes. "So, I take it this is the arena?" Shoto said. H nodded and spread her arms wide. "Dream, if you can, a courtyard," she said. "An ocean of violets in blue." Shoto grinned and cracked his knuckles. "Okay then," he said. "Let's do this." He took a few steps toward the temple entrance, but H grabbed him and pulled him back. "Not yet," H said. "As soon as we cross that threshold, the shitstorm will begin. We need to gear up first." She opened her inventory and took out the cloud guitar she'd retrieved from First Avenue. She flipped it over, revealing a love symbol-shaped cavity in the back of its body, just like the one in the cockpit of our UFO. H took the glowing purple love symbol power cell out of her inventory, too, and slapped it into the back of the cloud guitar. It fit perfectly, like a battery. Then she flipped the guitar over again and pressed the small love symbol-shaped power button directly beneath its bridge. I heard a low harmonic hum that rapidly increased in volume as the strings, fret markers, and pickups began to glow and crackle with purple energy. "You mentioned that you were taking guitar lessons," H said, "to learn how to play a real guitar?" "Yeah," I said, still staring at the instrument in her hands. "Why? Are you any good?" I shrugged and clenched my hands into fists because I was worried they might start shaking. "Well, I'm no Yngwie Malmsteen or anything," I said. "I'm still learning." "School's out, Yngwie," she said, holding the cloud guitar out to me. "Duty calls." I reached out and took it from her carefully, using both hands, while bowing my head slightly, thinking about the time Shoto presented me with his slain brother's sword. "The cloud guitar is an afterworld artifact," H said. "Its most powerful sonic attacks can only be activated if the wielder actually knows how to play the guitar and can properly finger the chord progressions. None of that guitar hero stuff you pulled on Megadon will fly. This has to be the real deal." "Okay," I said, taking it from her. "Thanks, H." "Open up its item description," she said, "right now. Before we go in there, you need to memorize all of the special attack licks and power chords. This is one of the few weapons that will affect all seven iterations of the purple one, but the guitar will overheat and explode after you use it to take one of the princes down. So try to take out as many of his henchmen as you can with it first before you go after one of the seven. Got it?"
"Prince has henchmen too?" Shoto said. "Who are they?"
"His backup bands," H said. "There are dozens of different NPC incarnations of Prince on this planet, depicting the purple one during all of the different phases of his career. Depending on which seven incarnations we face, some of them may not have a backup band. Like Proto-Prince, because he played every single instrument on his first two albums. But if Graffiti Bridge Prince shows up, he'll be backed by the new power generation. They will funk you up badly, my friend. The one you have to watch out for is Third Eye Prince, because not only does he shoot percussive blasts of sonic enlightenment out of his third eye, he's also backed up by Third Eye Girl. If we have to face Purple Rain Prince and he's backed up by the Revolution, we're probably done because they're unstoppable, especially here on their home turf. But the time is on our side," I said, glancing back at our henchmen. "They look pretty tough." "They are," H said. "Prince created their band, but they were all so insanely talented that they evolved and grew into something beyond his control.
They aren't going to save us, though, Z. If we're really lucky, they might be able to help us take down Graffiti Bridge Prince and the NPG. Maybe even Proto Prince, too. But the others? She shook her head. No way, no day. It would take a miracle for us to survive this fight. I'm not trying to be negative here. I'm just trying to prepare you for what's about to go down. Great, I said, slapping her on the back. Excellent confidence booster. Thanks, H. She turned to look at Shoto. What about you, Living Correct? She said. Do you play any musical instruments? I mean, other than the kazoo. Shoto scowled at her and shook his head. H sighed. Then she opened her inventory and took out a tambourine and tossed it to him. He caught it one-handed. Do your best with that, she told him. So what instrument do you play, H? Shoto asked indignantly. Don't worry about me, she replied. I sing. She glanced at me. You ready to do this, Z? I nodded and gave her a thumbs up, and she gave me one in return. Then she took a deep breath and led us forward through the open gates of the arena with the original seven members of Morris Day and the Time backing us up. 0023. When all 10 members of our party had passed through the gates, it triggered a needle drop, and the song Thieves in the Temple began to play as a dense red fog appeared. It swirled around our legs as it rapidly blanketed the entire floor of the courtyard. H led us to the center of the arena, then motioned for us to stop there. The three chains of gold will protect us from their attacks for a limited amount of time, she shouted to me and Shoto. We need to make it count and funk them up as much as we can while we can. Understood? Before we could reply, there was a booming crash of thunder, and streaks of purple lightning arced across the sky over our heads. Prepare yourselves for battle, H shouted to our entire crew. The seven are being teleported here now from different parts of the afterworld. Then, H said what she always used to say to me, whenever we appeared to be facing a no-win situation. Nice working with you, Dr. Venkman. This always used to make me chuckle, but now it hit too close to home. See you on the other side, Ray, I recited, clutching the neck of the cloud guitar like it was a particle thrower. As we spoke, seven large glass cylinders began to rise up out of the billowing red fog, forming a wide circle around us. Each of these glass cylinders had a metal cap at the top and the bottom, like a giant fuse. And, standing motionless inside each of them, was a different incarnation of his royal badness. Each one had a different hairstyle and outfit, apparently representing different stylistic phases of Prince's career. Before I could get a good look at any of them through the fog, all seven chambers opened and the seven princes emerged in unison, stepping forward into the arena. As they did so, the menacing opening guitar riff of the song When Doves Cry began to echo through the arena at ear-splitting volume. When the drums kicked in a few seconds later, all seven incarnations of Prince stretched out their arms as one and began to rise slowly from the ground. I craned my neck upward to see them all hovering directly above us, glaring down at us like seven angry Kryptonian gods intent on giving us a Smallville-style smackdown. They were a terrifying sight to behold. Don't look directly in their eyes, I heard H shout at us. Never look in any of their eyes, okay? I immediately averted my eyes and saw Shoto do the same thing. H caught us both staring at the ground. I didn't tell you to avoid looking at them, H shouted. Just avoid looking any of them in the eye for longer than a second or two, or they'll go berserk, okay? I nodded and glanced back up at them, still levitating above and around us in what was now a slowly rotating circle. The most imposing to me by far was Purple Rain Prince. He wore a pair